The Torah content from now through Pesach has been sponsored by the Kofsky family in loving memory of Adira, who loved big ideas and asking big questions. Hello, I'm Rabbi Matt Schneeweis, and this is the Stoic Jew podcast, where we explore the relationship between Judaism and Stoicism. Today, we are going to do a Q&A episode, and I'm going to take up a question that was posed to me by one of my students in my Friday Q&As. And the student wanted, quote, practical advice on how to not care about having everybody like me. Okay, and he went on to elaborate about the problem that he has this feeling that he struggles with, where he wants everyone to like him, and it manifests itself in several ways, that he finds himself automatically saying yes to requests, or like feeling like he has to immediately like be of service or help people when they approach him. He also avoids bringing things up in conversations. Or reacting to within a conversation in ways that he perceives would cause conflict or make the other person dislike him, and other manifestations as well. So I heard this question, I thought about it, and I was immediately confronted with one of the big obstacles that's been standing in the way of me making these episodes, which is that this is a very, very, very big topic, okay? And in part because of my perfectionist tendencies, in part because of just a genuine desire to want to answer the question, then I kind of put a bunch of pressure on myself to feel like I have to like completely take up this topic in all of its, you know, manifold ways and address it in a comprehensive manner, which obviously is impossible. So what I'm going to do instead is I'm just going to share my thoughts that I had, and we can always do another episode later on. So my first thought is that this is a theme that is written about a lot by the Stoic thinkers, and I'm going to pull a quotation from each of them, okay? The first is from Seneca's letter number 52 on choosing our teachers. He says, "How foolish one must be to leave a lecture hall gratified by the applause of the ignorant. Why do you take pleasure in praise from those who you cannot praise yourself?" Similarly, Epictetus in Discourses, Book 1, Chapter 21 says, "Who are these people whose admiration you seek? Aren't they the ones you are used to describing as mad? Well then, is that what you want? To be admired by lunatics?" And Marcus Aurelius in Meditations, Book 7, Chapter 62 says, "Keep constantly in mind who these people are whose admiration you seek and what guiding principles they have. Then you will not blame them when they carelessly offend you, and you will have no further wish for their approval once you look into the sources of their motives and opinions." Now, the questioner, or the listener in this case, might object and say, "Whoa, whoa, 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 whoa. What do you mean to say that these are all lunatics and madmen and people without principles? You know, what if these what if there are good perfected people in the audience, or not in the audience, in the I guess the audience of the lecture hall whose approval you seek, right? I'm just going to dismiss everyone. What if I'm seeking the approval of my friends? My friends are not bad people or lunatics. But here's the thing. Here's the insidious thing: is that there is what the questioner is describing is an indiscriminate compulsion to be liked by everybody. Keyword everybody, right? And that is a different problem than caring about the opinion of specifically people whose opinions you value, okay? And I'm not even going to touch that. That's actually, I mean, it's a related issue, but it is a separate issue. In fact, I think I actually have another episode about that, which I will include in the show notes if I find it. But what the questioner is talking about here is what we would call a neurosis, okay? And the best definition of neurosis that I have seen is in the book Self-Analysis by Karen Horney, who was one of the first female students of Sigmund Freud. So she gives this beautiful definition of what it means, what a neurotic trend is. She says, "The outstanding characteristic of neurotic trends is their compulsive nature, a quality that shows itself in two main ways. First, their objectives are pursued indiscriminately. If it is affection a person must have," okay, that's like this case here, "he must receive it from friend and enemy, from employer and bootblack. A person obsessed by a need for perfection largely loses his sense of proportion. To have his desk in faultless order becomes as imperative for him as to prepare an important report in a perfect fashion. Moreover, the objectives are pursued with supreme disregard for reality and real self-interest. A woman hanging on to a man to whom she relegates all responsibility for her life may be utterly oblivious to such questions as whether that particular man is an entirely appropriate person to hang on to, whether she is actually happy with him, whether she likes and respects him. If a person must be independent and self-sufficient, he will refuse to tie himself to anyone or anything, no matter how much he spoils his life thereby. He must not ask or accept help, no matter how much he needs it. This absence of discrimination is often obvious to others, but the person himself may not be aware of it. As a rule, however, it will strike the outsider only if the particular trends are inconvenient to him, or if they do not coincide with recognized patterns. He will notice, for instance, a compulsive negativism, but may not become aware of a compulsive compliance. Okay, that's indication number one. Then she goes on. The second indication of the compulsive nature of neurotic trends is the reaction of anxiety that ensues from their frustration. This characteristic is highly significant because it demonstrates the safety value of the trends. A person feels vitally threatened if, for any reason, internal or external, the compulsive pursuits are ineffective. A perfectionistic person feels panicky if he makes any mistake. A person with a compulsive need for unlimited freedom becomes frightened at the prospect of any tie, whether it be an engagement to marry or the lease of an apartment. A good illustration of fear reactions of this kind is contained in Balzac's Chagrin Leather. I'm not familiar with what that is. The hero in the novel is convinced that his span of life is shortened whenever he expresses a wish, and therefore he anxiously refrains from doing so. But once, when off his guard, he does express a wish, and even though the wish itself is unimportant, he becomes panicky. The example illustrates the terror that seizes a neurotic person if his security is threatened. He feels that everything is lost if he lapses from perfection, complex independence, or whatever standard it is that represents his driving need. It is this security value that is primarily responsible for the compulsive character of the neurotic trends. So to sum it up, neurotic trends are have objectives that are pursued indiscriminately, and they respond with a disproportionate reaction of anxiety when they are not met, when they are frustrated. Okay, so that is the type of trend we're dealing with here. When you have a person who needs to be liked by everybody, so there's the indiscriminateness of needing to be liked by everybody, and then there's the fact that there is anxiety when you feel like you are not going to be liked, or when you feel like someone's going to express dislike towards you, right? So there's a whole host of approaches and solutions to this, which is really what the questioner was asking for. Well, the first thing that actually came to my mind is from Aesop's Fables, and I'm sure there's different written versions of the Aesop's Fable, but the version I heard, I don't know what it's called, but I guess the man with two girlfriends. So the fable is about a man who is a middle-aged man, and he's dating two women, I think, who don't know about each other. Yeah, I think they don't know about each other. So he's dating an older woman, okay, and a younger woman. So when this middle-aged guy is with the younger woman, then she's somewhat self-conscious about being with a middle-aged guy. So she, when he's not looking, when he's asleep or whatever, then she plucks out his gray hairs, okay, because she doesn't want to be seen with an older guy. And when the guy is with the older woman, so she's kind of ashamed to be with someone who's much younger than she is, so she plucks out the black hairs. And what happens? At the end of the day, the guy ends up bald and probably ends up being found out by each of the girlfriends and loses his relationships, right? So the moral of the story is if you try to be liked by everybody, you'll end up being liked by nobody, right? And that is what is going to happen if you try to be liked by everybody. Because if you want people, let's say, who enjoy a certain aspect of your personality but are turned off by another aspect. So what happens if you get into the company of people who feel the reverse, right? So you can't make everybody happy all the time, and you're gonna end up upsetting somebody. So one route is just to realize the futility of being liked by everybody, okay? Another route towards undoing this is to recognize the consequences of trying to be liked by everybody, is that how far are you going to go, right? Like, let's say someone does not want to be friends with you if you're interested in learning, or if you are religious or whatever, you know? So you're going to conform to them, You're going to compromise your own values. What if someone doesn't like you unless you participate in a crime or a bad decision or a hate, you know? So like, how far are you going to take it? And since we're dealing with a neurotic trend, then there is no telling how far you're going to take it. Okay. So these are what I would call like practical ways to deal with it. Okay. To deal with the problem and to answer the question, which is what the questioner was asking for. But here's the thing. When the questioner first said, how can I practically, what practical advice can you give me to not care about having everybody like me? My first reaction is, whoa, whoa, whoa. Why are you trying to eliminate this trend in yourself to get yourself to not care about having everyone like you? Okay. So, and that's really what I want to focus on for the remainder of this episode. So I was actually going to start with Michelet, okay? But then I was reading, I have a couple of daily books that I read, and one of them is a daily book of excerpts from the writings of Jiddu Krishnamurti. And in this morning, on November 1st, this morning's episode, I came across something that I think is relevant to this, okay? So the title in this collection is On Breaking Habits, okay? This is from his Collected Works, Volume 6, page 56, okay? Here's what he says. Let us find out how to understand this whole process of habit forming and habit breaking. We can take the example of smoking, and you can substitute your own habit, your own particular problem, and experiment with your own problem directly as I am experimenting with a problem of smoking. It is a problem. It becomes a problem when I want to give it up. As long as I am satisfied with it, it is not a problem. The problem arises when I have to do something about a particular habit, when the habit becomes a disturbance. Smoking has created a disturbance, so I want to be free of it. I want to stop smoking. I want to be rid of it, to put it aside. So my approach to smoking is one of resistance or condemnation. That is, I don't want to smoke, so my approach is either to suppress it, condemn it, or find a substitute for it. Instead of smoking, to chew. Now, can I look at the problem free of condemnation, justification, or suppression? Can I look at my smoking without any sense of rejection? Try to experiment with it now as I am talking, and you will see how extraordinarily difficult it is not to reject or accept. Because our whole tradition, our whole background is urging us to reject or to justify rather than to be curious about it. Instead of being passively watchful, the mind always operates on the problem. Now, this is part of a larger approach to dealing with problems and to dealing with life in general. But what Krishnamurti is suggesting is that let's take our case here, right? Is I see in myself I have a need to be liked by everybody, and I immediately say, how can I stop that, right? How can I condemn it? Or sorry, how can I stop that? And in doing so, I am condemning it. I'm pushing myself away from it, right? But what happens if you just recognize this is a part of me, okay? And instead of approaching it with resistance, I approach it with curiosity. And that's not to say that I endorse it, right? Someone who's smoking might, you know, is harming their body, right? But the question is, can you set that aside for the moment and just look at it and try to see it objectively without rejecting or accepting it? And one of the best approaches to this that I've seen is really in IFS, in Internal Family Systems Therapy, which was founded and developed by Richard Schwartz. His most recent book is No Bad Parts. But in IFS, you really recognize that whatever this compulsion is, and however destructive it is, right? Even if it's something that is like violent or self-destructive, it's coming from something that is a part of me. And that part, one of the premises of IFS is that part is trying to do something that it believes is good. And in order to make any headway with this, to get rid of it, to do whatever you want to do, you have to understand it and meet it at its own level and see that it is a part of you, accept that it's a part of you, not push it away, not suppress it, not what Schwartz calls exiles it, and commune with it, talk with it, and see what it has to say. Okay. So when I first heard this question, I was like, oh, you just want to like eliminate this part of you. Well, why not get to know it? And I think that Krishnamurti excerpt really does a good job of like seizing that moment and then directing your attention elsewhere. But what the direction that my mind took was really in Michelet. Okay, now One of the differences between Mishlei and Koheles, the book of Proverbs and the book of Ecclesiastes, both written by Shlomo HaMelech, by King Solomon, is that while both books are focused on employing chachma, employing wisdom, living a life of wisdom, Koheles really questions the ends and does not really talk about the means, whereas Mishlei does not question the ends and only talks about the means. Okay, so for example, let's say you have a person who wants to be wealthy, okay? So Koheles will challenge and will say, oh, you think wealth is going to make you happy? Well, here's a bunch of reasons why it's not going to make you healthy, and this is just an illusory pursuit, okay? Mishlei, on the other hand, will say, oh, you want to be wealthy? Okay, great. I'm not going to challenge that. I'm not going to try to disabuse you of that notion. Let me tell you how to be rich, wealthy through chachma instead of trying to do it through foolishness. So that's a main difference between how Mishlei and how Koheles deal with our desires and values. So if you look at Mishlei, Mishlei would say in this issue, oh, you know, so Koheles would say, let me back up. Koheles would say, oh, you want to be liked by everybody? That is going to be impossible, and here's a bunch of reasons why. Don't pursue it. It's not worth it. What Mishlei is going to say is, oh, you want to be liked by everybody? Well, here's what you should do with that desire. Here's how to be liked by everybody. And it will lean into it, okay? An example of this is early in Mishlei, in chapter 3, pasuk 4, when it's talking about following Mishlei, it says, as a result, umetza chen v'seichel tov b'enei Elokim v'adam. You will find favor and good success in the eyes of God and in the eyes of man, okay? Now, you could stop there and say, well, wait, why do we even care about what favor we find in the eyes of man, right? I shouldn't care what people think. But I think you can argue that what Mishlei is doing is saying, no. The average student of Mishlei cares about what people think. We care what others think. So the question is, how can we channel that, harness that in a manner where we will maximize our ability to achieve favor in the eyes of other people and in the eyes of God. And really, the eyes of God is going to be the main thing. And ultimately, you're going to wean yourself off of caring what people think. But the point is that Mishlei embraces this tendency, recognizes that this is a part of us, and then we lean into it and redirect it in a positive way. This whole approach to dealing with our Yetzer Hara, with dealing with our evil inclination, is expressed perhaps most famously in Chazal, in the Sages' interpretation of the second sentence of the Shema in Devarim 6:5, V'ahavta es Hashem Elokecha b'chol levavcha v'chol nafshecha v'chol me'odecha. You should love Hashem your God with all your heart, all your soul, and all your resources. And the Chazal, the sages, say in the Mishnah in Brachos chapter 9, Mishnah 5, or Daf Nun Dalet Amud Aleph, b'chol levavcha b'shnei yitzrecha, with your two inclinations, b'yitzer tov or b'yitzer hara. There are many commentators who expound on this. I'm just going to quote one from the Meiri in his commentary on Pirkei Avos 2:12. He says, "Kolomar shafilu be'es shetaasek be'ulas hayeter." Even when you are engaged in an activity of the yeter, of the evil inclination, tihe kavanascha latachlis tov. Your intention, your objective, should be for a good outcome. V'alzeh atzad yikari hayeter hara tov. And in this sense, the yeter hara is called good. Omram Zal, the Bereishis Rabbah Perek Tes, as the sages say in the Midrash Bereishis Rabbah chapter 9, V'yar Elokim es kol asher asah v'hine tov ma'od, and God saw everything that he made, and behold, it was very good. And then the Midrash says, V'hine tov ze yitzer hara. When it says, behold, it was good, that's referring to the yitzer hara. V'chi yitzer hara tov, is it saying that yitzer hara is good? Malamed, this teaches you she'ilamal yitzer hara lo haya ha'olam miskayim. This is teaching you that were it not for the yitzer hara, the world would not persist. So my understanding of this is I couldn't find the other Gemara, the famous Gemara about, you know, if you how do you serve God with your yitzer hara? Well, if you have aggressive tendencies, then you should become a shochet. You should become a butcher. Or David HaMelech, you know, had a warmongering tendency, so he channeled it for waging the wars of Hashem. So really, I think that that is a different approach that should at the very least be considered, that instead of saying, how can you give me advice on how not to care about having everybody like me? Maybe the other approach is to say, no, I, at this stage of my life, want everybody to like me. How can I channel that in a manner that will be beneficial and not detrimental? And through doing that, you are working with your yetzer hara, And that's going to be ultimately the way to so to speak, get rid of it. You're not going to get rid of it by suppressing it or by like directly opposing it, I don't think. I think your best bet is to channel it in the right direction. So for example, my Rebbe, Rabbi Moskowitz, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, said that, you know, we all have low lishmas. We all have ulterior motives for engaging in Torah and mitzvos. Chazal say mitok shelo lishma ba lishma, that from these ulterior motives, you'll ultimately come to do it for its own sake. But most of us are going to be primarily operating on a low lishma basis for a long time. And Rabbi Moskowitz said, what is the best low lishma? Is that you should learn Torah so you could be viewed as a chacham, as someone who's wise. Okay. And why is that the best low lishma? Because then at least what you'll do is you'll ask yourself, you'll say like, what would a chacham do in this situation? And you'll do what is the most wise thing. So I think that maybe that approach can be used here as well, which is to recognize that chachamim are going to treat everybody in a manner that will be beneficial for them, okay? Meaning that they'll care about their fellow human being and will relate to them in a manner that is good for them and will be appreciated. So perhaps you should take that desire to be liked by everyone and say, well, how can I relate to this person as a chacham would relate to this person? And therefore, you're not trying to eliminate the desire to be liked by them, but you're channeling it in a way that will cause you to develop the qualities of a chacham, and it will have the desired effect is that they will like you, but it will also wean you off of the neurotic way of relating to that effect of this trend, which is you won't be doing things that are self-destructive or are destructive to the relationship. You'll be doing things that are going to be in the best interest of yourself and the relationship. And gradually, over time, you will care less and less about what people think, but you'll care more about what chachma thinks. Okay, what reality thinks, or to put it in the terms that Mishlei was using, to care about what God thinks, right? I'll conclude with one of my favorite quotations from Plato. So Socrates in the Crito says, "Then, my friend, we must not regard what the many say of us, but what he, the one man who has understanding of the just and unjust, will say, and what the truth will say. And therefore, you begin an error when you suggest that we should regard the opinion of the many about the just and the unjust, good and evil, honorable and dishonorable." And that's really what we mean by having favor in the eyes of God, which is the only thing ultimately that should matter is what does God think? And it just happens to be that if you align yourself with what God thinks, then generally speaking, people will like you. That's a whole other topic as well. But it's not going to be everybody. It's not going to satisfy your neurosis. Okay, that's my first attempt to answer that question. Again, this is a big topic and it's multifaceted. And so I'm sure there's more to be said. And if you have follow-up questions, then please let me know and we'll try to take it up one at a time. Before I do the sign-off, I want to announce, because I don't think I've announced it on this podcast, I recently started a Substack. A Substack is a new, fairly new medium for akin to blogging. It allows you to sign up and receive in your inbox written articles written by me. I created the Substack because I've been using Blogger for my blog for 15 years. The most recent blog I have has close to 400 articles, but I typically only write on a regular basis during the summer, and I wanted to try writing during the year, at least one article a week, and I'm going to keep it to one-page articles during the week, by and large. So I started a Substack just because I wanted a new medium, and I'm trying it out. And so if you are interested in my writing, then you can sign up for you can subscribe for free to the Substack. Right now, I am not going to have any content that I charge money for, because I want my Torah to be available and accessible to everyone. If I do ever make an actual subscription model, I would only put non-Torah content behind the paywall. I would not put Torah content behind the paywall. So the Substack can be found at rabbischneeweis.substack.com and also be found in the show notes to this episode. And that is it for today's episode. If you've gained from what you've learned here today, please consider contributing to my Patreon at www.patreon.com/RabbiSchneeweis. Alternatively, if you'd like to make a direct contribution to the Rabbi Schneeweis Torah Content Fund, my Venmo is at Nat-Schneeweis, and my Zelle and PayPal are matschneeweis@gmail.com. Even a small contribution goes a long way to covering the cost of my podcast and will provide me with the financial freedom to produce even more Torah content for you. If you would like to sponsor a day's or a week's worth of content, or if you are interested in enlisting my services as a teacher or tutor, you can reach me at RabbiSchneeweis@gmail.com. Thank you to my listeners for listening. Thank you to my readers for reading, and thank you to my supporters for supporting my efforts to make Torah ideas available and accessible to everyone.